Accession number 8225, rule number 4.
Mr. McCausland, rule 4.
The Schulenburg-Wolfsburgs were very grand indeed. They had owned the Wolfsburg Schloss, which was later taken over by Hitler to produce the Volkswagen. And to compensate them, during the war, this enormous Schloss was built for them. And it had a great many bedrooms. It housed every man in the squadron. And we had a lovely time. We occupied the village in which the Schloss was, and we ran it for several weeks before the Control Commission took over. You see, after the war, there was no authority in Germany at all, and the troops ran the whole thing. And then the Control Commission took over, and they ran it, and then the Germans, of course. But so we had to have some sort of law and order, and we found two old men, and we made them policemen. And we had a sort of court which we heard German complaints and so on against each other and one thing and another, not very efficiently. And we tried to safeguard their food by looking after their potato clamps. we let them set guards on that so that no one would steal those, because we didn't know how much food there was. There wasn't very much around, actually. And altogether, we had a distillery. We had the only distillery in Northwest Europe, as far as I know, that was really working. And we used to send people out to gather hay and grass, and we gave that to the Germans, who made it into Napoleon brandy. And we this is really true. And we sold this at vast prices to the Russians and to the Americans. And the Russians have been drinking V2 fuel, so they're very pleased that they used to come across and buy all this stuff. And the men got quite a lot of money. We split the profits between the men and the Germans. The officers, unfortunately, didn't take any. Otherwise, I'd be much richer. It wasn't actually a bad drink. Our doctor condemned it as unfit for human consumption, but we drank it ourselves. You've got flies in the bottles all the time. I remember the mess that we had, these bottles of this pale coloured liquid full of flies, which we cheerfully drank. But eventually, actually, we found an SS store full of champagne, and we drank that instead. So that was better. And our activity was shut down, too. None of that kind of thing lasted very long.
How did you find out that the Russians had been drinking Vito fuel?
They told us. The Russian officers, right at the beginning of the war, used to come along on motorbikes. They weren't supposed to. Their chaps didn't let them. We didn't let them. They did it just the same. And you used to chat to them. We met one Russian officer at a bridge which we had to cross. They were on the one side, we were on the other. And I remember talking to him and asking him to countermand some orders that he'd given. He said he'd like to do it, but he said his men were so stupid that once you were given an order, you had to keep that order going. It was not possible to alter it. This was infantry, but the Russian tank people were very different. They were obviously highly intelligent and very quite a different sort of kettle of fish. I imagine that so many Russian infantrymen had been killed that what they had left was fairly uneducated and peasanty.
Were they friendly towards you, the Russians,
yes,
or not?
Yes, very friendly, yes.
Was there any exchange of presents or anything of that kind?
No, nothing like that, nothing at all. No, there weren't. We had a Russian officer in the mess. There was a river which was going to be the boundary, and he and the colonel had to negotiate the actual physical boundary on the ground for a small stretch. I mean, it was only a little bit. And it took days of arguing to get this chap to give an inch to make. We thought you should follow the river like that along the course of the river. He tried to get little bits on our side of the river and not give little bits on his side, and this went on for days. It's perfectly ludicrous. In the end, he gave in as he had to. No, the Russians were perfectly friendly. Eventually we had to go, and they came into the Schloss, and actually I saw them do it. They shot it up. The Russians shot it up with submachine guns inside, just blazing away. And then they said we did it. complaints came across the border later on saying we did it, we didn't, because I swore I didn't do it, and there was no reason why we should.
What was our reason for doing it?
Oh, I don't know. They didn't like Germans much, I think. And they, it's the kind of thing you do in war, I think. The war was over, but nonetheless.
Did they seem bitter against the Germans?
I don't know. We didn't really talk about that kind of thing. I don't know at all. I have no idea. Germans were terrified of them. But they did behave quite well towards them, because we had... When we went west, some Germans from the Salzwedel area came over to us because they had got friendly with the troops, which they shouldn't have done, of course, but they did. I mean, there's supposed to be no fraternizing, but obviously there was. And they said that when the Russians arrived, they raped every single woman of any age in the village, which the Germans had expected because they knew that happened. And after that, they said the Russians behaved quite well. The Russian officer told them that no one would harm them during the daytime, no one would go into their houses in the day or in the night, but if they went out at night, he couldn't guarantee what would happen to them, which at that stage was fair enough.
Going back to something you said earlier about the adjudication of cases that the Germans brought to you, what kind of cases were they bringing?
Oh, somebody's stolen somebody's bicycle and that kind of thing. I mean, very trivial things. Nothing of much interest or importance.
You said that when you were talking about the sinking of the two ships, that the bodies were washed up on the shore. Did you see any of those washed up bodies?
Yes.
In what kind of numbers?
Oh, an awful lot. I just remember nothing about the German attitude. Before the war finished, almost at the end of it, one of our armoured cars was destroyed by a Panzerfaust at the entrance to a village. And I think the driver was killed. And we didn't go into the village because we wanted to save our own lives. And so we got our heavy mortars up and we bombarded this village. And you have an awful lot of firepower by 1939, 45 standards in a reconnaissance squadron. I mean, you've got the 2-pounder guns on the cars, you've got the mortars, you've got the machine guns, heavy machine guns and so on. And it was a little village and we just went at it for about a quarter of an hour. And in fact, we were firing mostly at a primary school filled with children who were in the cellar. So I don't think any of them were hurt. And then we went into the village and the people were very friendly when we got in. They weren't at all hostile to us, which I think they might well have been.
Had you had any knowledge of concentration camps before you came across Neustadt?
No. It wasn't a concentration camp. It was a transit camp for concentration camp prisoners.
Did you know about concentration camps?
I can't remember now. I can't remember whether Belsen had happened then. I think we did. I think we knew about Belsen. Yes, my brother was at Belsen, and I think he wrote to me about it, actually. I knew pretty well as soon as Belsen was discovered, because he was a medical student at St. Thomas's, and he was flown across, they said to Holland, to relieve the Dutch, but in fact they diverted them on the way to Belsen, and they hadn't inoculated any of these medical students against anything. He was put in charge of a great big hut full of people and given a thermometer and a packet of aspirins and told to cope. And he brought that most dreadful photographs of it. And he wrote to me about it. So I think I probably, if Belsen happened before Neustadt, then I did know about it. But I don't remember now whether it did or not.
Going back to the campaign in Northwest Europe, what was the character of the German troops against whom you were fighting?
Oh, they fought extremely fairly. If that's what you mean, no complaints at all. Against us, they fought very chivalrously, and as I said, the 4th Parachute Division fought extremely well. They were very, very fine troops indeed. And I think I remember one of them who we captured seeing that they fought well not because they were interested in Hitler, not because they were interested in Nazism, but because they were the finest troops in the world. And it was the regimental pride, really.
Because German troops are the finest in the world?
No. Their regiment, their was the finest in the world. It was. I don't think you get national pride in fine, you get regimental pride, really.
What about the age of the German troops against whom you were fighting?
Well, in Italy they were the same age as we were. In Northwest Europe they were children. By children, I mean 15, 16, a lot of them were 15, 16, 17, that sort of age. When I say that, I mean you don't see troops you're fighting, but I did see people dead on the road who were aged about 15. In fact, no one was, because I took his paybook from him. Which I felt rather guilty about, but he had an identity disc anyway. He was a boy. And yes, in our divisional, you have a divisional intelligence officer, and they told us actually that women were fighting against, going to fight against, and did fight against. I never heard that, also. I don't think that's true. But certainly young boys did. They didn't fight terribly well, actually.
In what way?
Well, it's difficult to explain, and they weren't so technically efficient as and the parachutists were far the best, and you wouldn't expect young boys to fight very well. They don't know enough. They hadn't enough experience.
Can you tell me something about the method by which your vehicles advanced in northwestern Europe?
Yes, well, we had a drill. I mean, you didn't just dash ahead. The drill was that, which you trained for interminably. You had a drill for everything, actually, but it usually didn't work. The area was divided into green, amber, and red districts. Green meant you could go as fast as you like, knew there weren't any Germans, there had no enemy. Amber, you went sure, so you went moderately slowly. Red, you went very slowly indeed. And what you did was that you would have one armoured car would go ahead, and he'd be covered by the guns of another armoured car, which would be stationary, hull down. And when the leading armoured car got to a corner or a hill or whatever it was, he would stop. And they might get out and have a look to see if there was anything ahead of them. And if they couldn't see anything, they would signal on the second armoured car who would pass them and would be covered by the guns of the first armoured car. So in effect, they'd leapfrog each other. And that would continue. It didn't really work terribly well because it was all sort of muddled up with woods and things, and in practice you couldn't do it really efficiently. But it did help. I mean, you did feel that someone was covering you. You did feel that if you felt it was dangerous, you would stop and get out and look. And it wasn't just driving ahead. It was very nerve-wracking being in the first car and the leading car, and imagine going down any road and you think there's going to be somebody at the end of it with an anti-tank weapon. And that's no fun. It's no fun for the driver particularly, who couldn't get out very easily. You drove with your turret open all the time, of course, so it was much easier for the gunner and the commander to get out, but not for the driver.
At what time would the vehicles be most vulnerable? At what time of day and under what conditions would they be their most vulnerable?
Well, I don't think time of day mattered at all, but they were very vulnerable, of course, when you were in sort of built-up areas. They were very vulnerable in towns, they were very vulnerable in woods. And they were very vulnerable when the chaps lost their way, which is there was one chap called Henry Sutcliffe who lost his way in Italy and got killed as a result. You see, you've got to be able to see ahead to be reasonably safe. If you can't see more than a few yards ahead, there may be anything there.
Earlier on still, you were talking about passing through France, Belgium and the Netherlands. What was the condition of the civilian population in those countries so soon after liberation?
I don't think we saw them very much. And France, yes, we did. We saw the French peasants. They looked pretty poor. I mean, I don't think many people wore shoes. They wore clogs and things like that. They looked quite well fed, but they did look poor. Belgium seemed to be all right. Holland, I don't remember. I can't really tell you much about that. There was a general impression of great poverty. And, of course, a great many towns were ruined and so on. But I don't remember seeing people looking hungry.
Was the population of these countries welcoming towards you, or was that, did you come across any hostility?
No, no hostility. The French just tried to make money out of us. But they certainly weren't hostile in any way at all. Oh, no. The Belgians were extremely friendly. We didn't... If we went through Holland, it was only quickly. I mean, I don't... At the edge of it, I don't think I met any Dutch or anything about it. We didn't have an awful lot to do with civilians, you see, except just very occasionally and when we were stationary. Yes, I remember one occasion in Germany, one place we stopped at and the war was still on. It was a farm, a grandish sort of farm, and the troops started burning a lot of wooden farm materials. I took from pots and carts and things. Not out of bloody-mindedness, because they wanted to get warm and they wanted to cook and so on. And I remember the German, the daughter of the farm, came to me outraged and ordered me to stop them. No fear at all, and absolutely confident I would, which I did. But I admired her. I thought she was very good. When the war ended, I was surprised that I wasn't at all elated. I just felt a sort of slightly lost feeling, relieved a little bit that one was safe now, but not very happy. I didn't know what to do. I knew I'd have to be a solicitor. I didn't want to be a solicitor. And what one knew about was all finished. And I think I'd only had one leave at home in the 2 years that I'd been abroad, and I hadn't liked it much when I had got home. Because it was rather depressing, blackouts and bad food and one thing and another. So what you'd known for what seemed an awfully long time had vanished, and there seemed to be nothing to take its place. And when I did get home, I remember feeling rather sad, because I saw one of our corporals digging up the road in Chancery Lane when I was going up to the Law Society, and we talked. And I was glad to see him, and I think he was glad to see me, but there was really nothing to say, and so it was all gone.